From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do you ever find yourself getting bored with the food you eat? Is comfort food getting just a little too comfortable? Maybe it's time to take a walk on the culinary wild side.
What does a grilled coconut grub taste like?
Crunchy, but delicious.
Welcome to the latest culinary trend, adventure eating. Ever try roasted guinea pig? How about baby duck embryos? They'll put the thrill back in your dinner, all right. But they're not for the faint of heart or stomach.
I'm kind of sporty myself, and I do a lot of sporting activities that give you a bit of an adrenaline rush. And these certainly are items that do sort of convey that sensation of standing on the edge of the platform with a bungee jump attached.
So the head and the little feet come off.
Yes.
In this hour, the world of extreme eaters, people who travel the globe eating everything your mom, not to mention your doctor, told you never to touch. But then who makes all those food rules anyway? Join us as we talk about how America became a nation of food police, and we'll meet a woman for whom one dessert is never enough.
You can have dark chocolate brownies. You can have quintuple brownies, so it has five different kinds of chocolate. White chocolate brownies with raspberries and a meringue top. That's kind of the dressy brownie.
So many things to eat. So little time.
Hamburgers, cheeseburgers, spaghetti rice, french fried potatoes and goulash. Take over easy asparagus sphere, hot dogs and baked beans and sauerkraut. Red button mushrooms in chicken pot pie, pink lemonade on the 4th of July.
There is a world of food out there waiting for you and me. But I bet your list of favorite foods doesn't include grilled grubs or fried crickets. And those are just two of the foods featured on Andrew Zimmern's new TV show, Bizarre Foods. The Travel Channel show is only in its first season, but audiences have already seen the intrepid Zimmern, a former chef and food writer, eat more strange foods in more unusual locations than most people know exist. Zimmern told Ann Strangechamps he's out to broaden viewers' culinary horizons. Americans, he says, have become narrow-minded about food.
Here's the big issue. I think essentially it comes down to a psychology of negativism that we've bred into ourselves culturally in the same way that people in other parts of the world don't eat cheese. They consider it to be spoiled pieces of rotten milk that have been hardened in some way, and they laugh at the idea. Whereas in our country, we frown on the idea that children in Thailand in the mountains will celebrate festivals by eating chili and garlic sautéed bats. But spend some time in a Thai village and watch the kids dive. After, I mean, it's like they're like chicken wings there. I mean, they can't get enough of them. There's no psychological disconnect for people. So much, you know, the foods that we won't eat in this country are tied to psychological disconnect. We won't eat bugs. We won't eat bats. We won't eat snakes. We won't eat, you know, fill in the blank.
For those of you out there wondering how much of a head can you actually eat, well, as you can see, the answer is the whole thing. The lamb's tongue.
So if you're in Morocco and someone serves you a whole sheep's head, is there a polite way to go about eating it? I mean, or do you just start sawing away with your knife and fork?
Well, here's the interesting thing. The components of the head itself will actually disengage and you sort of pick your way around it. We ate a couple different times in the Jama El Fanah at different stalls, one of which was serving you halved roasted heads, and they'd actually shred the meat off for you if you were a Western to make it a little easier for you. They want you to enjoy these foods.
There is another delicacy in here that most people choose to pass up, but not me.
Well, I have to confess, it was all okay with me until you got to the eyeball.
All of the flavors of the lamb have sort of concentrated and pooled into this one globby, fatty, tissuey substance. That's good. There is no words on earth that can describe the texture of a roasted lamb's eyeball to you, but let me just tell you, it was the essence of the barnyard.
This is what I find fascinating. In so many parts of the world, and you sort of have to be careful of this when you're eating in the types of places that I am, what we think of as the most discouraging parts of the animal to eat are always the pieces that are reserved for, you know, honored guests. Anytime you're in another country and you're at a dinner party and someone says, we've saved something for our most honored guest, it's time to excuse yourself to the ladies or men's room unless you're an adventurous eater. Because what's about to happen to you is something that is just so far removed from our food reality is about to be served to you with everyone in the room staring at you while you're eating it. It's sort of a Murphy's Law of bizarre foods eating.
Moving on to the main dish, uwak.
These are the giant worms, the uwak.
The uwak, yes.
In adobo with soy sauce and vinegar.
Vinegar,
and
chili.
Onions, chilies.
There's some things in the Philippines you ate, like these things that look like really big, fat, white caterpillars.
They're called uwak. They're coconut grubs. I also ate them in Ecuador. Anywhere that has palm trees, the young palm trees rot and the coconut grubs feast on the insides. And I've eaten them actually in three or four different countries around the world. In Ecuador, they were the best. They marinated orange juice and grill, and they become all roasty, toasty, and crispy and delicious. And you can't stop eating them. They're so wonderful. In the Philippines, they don't clean them, and they just sauté them, and they let all the food that these grubs have eaten sort of sit in the inside of them and get hot.
You suck out all this stuff that's on the inside. All right. Cheers.
How does it taste?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I don't know what those things ate.
Something.
But they didn't digest it very well. That's very gritty and very, oh my gosh, you clean out the inside of that stuff, it's like jelly on the inside of there. It's worm jelly.
And then what about that other, let's see, mangrove worms you ate in the Philippines?
Oh, one of my great sorrows is that that's the type of food that I may never get the chance to eat again. We were on a deserted beach on the southernmost province of the Philippines called Palawan. I mean, a real Robinson Crusoe beach. And there were some native guys hacking away at mangroves that were growing by the side of the ocean. And they were pulling these 5-6-inch white worms that live in darkness. They have a little screw-top pull face at the top of them. And they just burrow their way through the mangrove, eating as they go and getting bigger and bigger and bigger, longer, longer and longer. And you dip them raw and wriggling into this calamansi juice. And then you just plop them down the throat. And it's just... oh, just delicious. You could snack on them really all day long.
Oh, that's a mangrove snake. Are you kidding me? Look at the face on him. He's got a face like a screw bit.
I was amazed. I ate two. That's how good they were.
Have you ever encountered a food you just couldn't handle?
Oh, gosh, yes. All the time.
The one time I saw you on your show come anywhere close to losing it was eating a Moroccan dish called kalia.
Oh, kalia. Well, that's putrefied meat.
The putrid and foul stench that accompanies the rotten, spoiled meat that we've mixed in here with our eggs this morning is doing two things simultaneously that I always thought were mutually exclusive. It's both scaring the pants off of me and attracting every fly within 500 kilometers of Etben Hadou. Little egg, a little bit of whatever this is. It's a mini breakfast burrito.
One of the issues with the kalia is that, you know, is the same reason I had problems eating stink heads, the putrefied salmon heads up in Alaska with the Yupiak Eskimo, is that in our culture, we are schooled that when something is putrefied or gone bad, you don't touch it.
Oh, my gosh. That is really strong. The smell through my nose is of rotted meat. I think I can. Oh my God. Oh my Lord.
You must have a cast iron digestive system. But
yeah, I'm the right guy for the job, for sure. And I'm extremely curious also.
Well,
aren't you curious?
Yes, I am. But I'm also really curious about just the health side of things. I guess I sort of wonder, do you have to have a specialist doctor on call? I mean, somebody you can call
no.
and say, can I eat this?
No, I don't. I sort of go with my gut. I mean, I'm an eater. I'm 45 years old. I've been eating my whole life. And, you know, I tell people all the time, I'm more scared of the sliced tomato and lettuce salad in the buffet line at the hotel in Marrakesh that my crew was eating than I was about anything I ate in the Jemaah El-Fanah.
You know, it's interesting to me that talking with you, one of the responses I have is this sense of exhilaration. And it's the same feeling I get from watching your show. And I think it's what happens when people push past a certain fear boundary. Suddenly the world feels so much bigger and so much more exciting. Is that the effect that you're kind of going for?
You know, we're not going for it, but we ended up with that. But what you're describing is exactly how I feel about doing what I'm doing. I love food and I love people, and I think it's the most exciting thing in the world to watch people connect over a bowl of fill in the blank. And I think in that Ecuador episode, when I sit down with the Pilchi Indians, my guide, Donaldo, and his family, I wanted to go eat with his family. And I met his kids, and we sat down on the floor of his cooking hut and ate mangrove worms and drank chicha. And I passed around a candy bar. And, you know, being able to experience those kind of foods in the places where they exist with the people who are still eating in what I call traditional pathways and methodologies, I think is the most exciting, fun experience you can possibly have. I think it's incredible. And the fact that I get to share those experiences and it's coming across that way, that it's exciting to people, just thrills me to death.
Let's talk about this for a second. There's a lot of elements of a hard-boiled egg.
Yes.
To it. So the really soft stuff is the... Oh, hello. There's the little guy. Yeah. Head and shoulders, neck and shoulders, and feet. So use this like a little scooper, pour a little salt.
Andrew Zimmern is host of the Travel Channel cable TV show Bizarre Foods. And Strange Hemp spoke with him.
Great green gobs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, mutilated monkey meat, dirty little pigeon feet, all mixed up with a pile of poison possum pus, and me without my spoon. Me without my spoon. And me without my spoon. Great green gobs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, and me without my spoon.
We'll use a straw.
Everyone has food likes and dislikes. But American culture today seems to be filled mostly with food warnings. Don't eat sugar, it'll make you diabetic. Don't eat fat, it'll clog your arteries. Don't eat meat, it's unethical and it'll make you sick. Don't eat carbohydrates, they'll make you fat, and on and on. University of Southern California sociologist Barry Glassner sums up Americans' current attitude toward food as the gospel of naught. He told Steve Paulson that we seem to think the value of a meal lies principally in what it lacks. The less sugar, salt, fat, calories, carbs, preservatives, additives, and other suspect stuff, the better the meal. You know, it's a wonder there's anything left to eat.
In the U.S. these days, and for quite a while, we view foods as either saintly or sinful or nutritious or healthy, very black and white, pro or con, good or bad, and with, I think, a kind of semi-religious overtone. And basically what I found in my research for the gospel of food is that whether a food was seen one way or another at a particular time seemed to have less to do with the food itself in many cases than with who was promoting it or denouncing it and their interests.
Well, give me some examples of that, how our thinking about particular foods has waxed and waned, why some things are considered bad one year and then perfectly healthy another year.
A great example of that is eggs. Eggs now are widely regarded and rightly regarded as staples of the human diet. They have a lot to offer, you know. They abound in protein and B vitamins and lots of other nutrients at relatively low cost. But if you look back just a short time, a couple of decades really, nutritionists, nutritional activists in particular, and some health writers, a lot of them actually, were warning to the general public that they should stay away from eggs. And as a result, egg consumption in the U.S. plummeted, even though the evidence for a link between egg consumption, certainly moderate egg consumption, and heart disease is slight to non-existent.
You're saying all of that concern about eating a lot of eggs leading to cholesterol is basically a myth, that the science just does not support that?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that is that even people who were advocating that back then have backed off from it and don't make that claim anymore. You know, we go through these cycles in general.
Right, right. And we've also heard about red meat, for instance. So for a long time, we heard that red meat was bad for you. Other times, it's been a staple of certain dieting plans. And the same with potatoes, the same with soy. The list goes on.
That's right. And they come and go. And I think that's on the approved, disapproved, sacred, saintly, demonic lists, you know, of where they're categorized. I think one of the more interesting surveys found that 9 out of 10 Americans believe that certain foods have benefits that go beyond basic nutrition. You know, I mean, we kind of believe in miracles in these foods. But exactly which foods and which benefits varies tremendously. If you're talking about red meat, for instance, at least a substantial number of the followers of the late Dr. Atkins believe that eating meat at every meal or most every meal is going to be a magical potion for them, for weight loss, for longevity, for health. And then at the opposite end of the same spectrum, vegans and vegetarians believe that their meatless regimen is saintly in itself, that it's going to prevent every serious malady from heart disease to world hunger.
Now, you are pretty cynical about how food is marketed, and I'm wondering if you could be more specific here in terms of what we should look for as consumers when we go out and buy food and we see all these warnings or we read about certain dietary advantages of using certain foods, avoiding others. How should we be more consumer aware?
I think one thing that we should always keep in mind is who is selling us this notion, and are they doing it this week, this month, this year? Is it likely to disappear next year? What was the one last year? You know, so right now as we're talking, omega-3 is a big item. It's appearing in everything. You know, it's been added to eggs. I saw some pet food that had it recently. You know, it was oat bran for a while, and you could buy oat bran beer and so forth. And, you know, falling for whatever is the current nutrient or additive or fad food or fad diet is almost always a mistake. They don't last, they don't persist, and they grossly oversimplify what's going on.
So what should we make of all of this? Is it just to do everything in moderation?
I'll tell you, this sort of mantra that I came away with is to eat well, eat enjoyably, and eat moderately over the long haul, and to keep trying to educate myself about who's marketing to me to which ends, and to try to be less naive about that. Part of what's left out in the contemporary American way of thinking about diet, it seems to me, is that enjoyment of the meal is very important. We sort of leave that out. You know, if a food is a pleasure to eat, that's beneficial in itself. I looked at some studies that suggest that at the physiological level, not just emotionally. You get more nutrients out of the meal if you're enjoying the meal.
Really? That's sort of amazing to think about. So a pleasurable meal will actually be healthier for you.
Oh, yeah. There's some research clearly showing that. And by the way, it sounds strange to us sort of because of our Puritan roots, I think. You know, we think that denial is going to make us healthier. But in some parts of the world, the official dietary guidelines come right out and say this. One country, if I remember correctly, I think it's Norway, in their official dietary guidelines says food and joy equal health. But the U.S. dietary guidelines don't allude to that kind of thing at all, and we don't tend to think that way here.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like that's more of a philosophy rather than, I don't know, nutritional or scientific guidelines. But you're saying that maybe you can't really separate the two.
I don't think it's just a philosophy. I mean, I think, you know, there's a very thin line, I guess is the way I would put it, between the philosophy of diet and then the official pronouncements that come out. And the official pronouncements that come out in the form of dietary guidelines and statements from nutritional advocacy groups and other places are very much a political product, as you would expect. They've come out of a lot of negotiations and such. That would be true in other countries as well as here. But here, what we think very commonly is that the closer we come to subscribing to the gospel of naught, the closer we come to keeping things out of our diet, the healthier we're going to be, rather than emphasizing also the enjoyment of the meal and the pleasures of the table.
Barry Glasner is a sociologist at the University of Southern California and the author of The Gospel of Food. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
Butter, I remember butter. We were once like lovers, we were quite a team. Sugar, I remember sugar, not much of a looker, but what a dream. I remember coffee-flavored Haagen-Dazs.
Coming up, journalist Krista Wiles' survey of the world's weirdest and most dangerous foods, including some that can kill you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Remember when you were a kid and just about everything you ate was new and strange and potentially gross? I mean, olives, yuck. Spinach, disgusting. Broccoli, ew. Well, now we've learned to eat and even like those things. Dinner is safer and also a little more boring. Journalist Krista Wiles wanted to see if she could recapture the thrill of eating on the edge. She's a fan of extreme sports, and she set out to make eating one of them. For the past few years, she's traveled around the world tasting every bizarre, repulsive, and downright dangerous food she could find. You can read about her adventures in her book Fierce Food, a catalog of the truly astonishing things people eat.
People get bored with the same kinds of foods day in and day out, and you'll find situations where people are eating things that are deliberately rotten, and you think, well, why would anybody ever do that? And I believe that that sort of came about as a result of just sheer boredom, and it's a slightly different flavor. It's a very strong flavor, and if it didn't kill you, it's something that you adapted to eating, and the taste that might have seemed very strange to the uninitiated palate became something that became a cultural lodestone, really, and something that people began to look forward to eating because they grew up with it, and it was a variation on a theme that was enjoyable for that very reason.
Give me an example. You must have several that are like that. What in Japan, for instance, is a cultural food?
I think that the number one example in Japan is a dish called natto, which are soybeans that have been allowed to ferment with a bacteria that originally was found in straw. So the idea is that at some point in the dark mists, somebody left a pot of cooked bean curds in straw or near straw, and the straw bacteria infiltrated the beans, and it created this kind of fermentation which resulted in, frankly, a very slimy kind of mucus that grew on the beans and imparted a very, very strong, you might say, ammoniac kind of flavor to them. And today, natto is an incredibly popular dish in Japan. You can buy it really on any street corner. It's not gourmet. It's something that's served in Denny's, in the Tokyo Denny's for breakfast. You can order natto. And it's kind of amazing because it's just, you know, you lift up the beans and these billows of kind of, well, it's like slime, really. And these billows of slime just blow off in the wind. And you put it in your mouth and you sort of get whacked with that flavor and just think, I don't know how this ever happened, that this food came about. But a Japanese person will, you know, you mention natto and this huge smile will spread across their face because it's beloved there.
You had the same sort of thing. Iceland? You have the shark meat?
Yeah, the hákarl. Yeah, this is shark meat that if it were eaten sort of unprepared properly, it would make you very sick because it has a lot of urea. So somehow somebody, again, back in the history of time, evolved a manner of preparing this meat so that it could be eaten, which is you bury it in the beach, under the beach gravel for several months, in which time bacteria set in that ferment it or possibly rot it. There is actually a difference, and I'm not quite remembering at this moment which of the two it is. But in any case, it gets harder.
I have a feeling
again.
It's important to remember at some point if you're actually going to
eat
it.
Well, I was corrected once. No, it's not rotten. It's fermented. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I've made a big mistake. But anyway, it smells very bad when it's dug up. And in order to alleviate that somewhat, it's hung to dry for another few months in a windy shack. And then it's ready to be consumed.
The windy shack is the important part, isn't it?
Right. And it still stinks, and it still tastes god-awful, but Icelanders eat it as part of this Viking celebration that they have at the end of January, and it's consumed in tiny little cubes, innocuous-looking pink cubes, and downed with tons and tons of caraway liqueur. And, you know, it reminds everybody of the Viking ancestry, and it's a wonderful national food, but apparently nobody really likes it. They eat it, they drink, and it's, you know, it's just done because it's done.
What is, do you think, the most disgusting thing you've eaten?
Well, the giant water bug was right up there, but that was sort of most bad before I ate it, just because of the way it looked. While I was eating it was a Swedish variation on the rotten shark theme, which is rotten herring in a can called surströmming. And it's, again, it's a national dish. There's great pride attached to it. And the funny thing is you can buy it sort of in any major food or fish cellar in the autumn months, and you allow it to ferment further. So you have a can in your fridge that is literally expanding and blowing up.
That's wrong.
It is wrong. You grow up and you hear that, no, that bulging can, you've got to call the manager in aisle three. There's something wrong here. You know, it can kill you. But they like that in Sweden. So the can is sort of blowing up and blowing up. And finally it gets to the point where you're really at risk of blowing out your entire fridge with surströmming, and that means a new fridge. So you have to open it up, and you do so in a can of water because apparently, well, I know this for a fact, the smell is so very bad that the can needs to be submerged so that the gas is contained in another medium besides air. And this...
You probably want to do this outside, too.
Well, it's food that must be eaten outside, yeah. And even so, it's unbelievable when you open that thing up, and it fizzes.
Did it taste good?
The taste is absolutely appalling. Again, this is something that is consumed with a great deal of, in this case, vodka, usually Absolut for national pride's sake. And it's something that people have grown up with, and so therefore, you know, they're a little bit inoculated against it. But boy, I had my first surströmming. It was last year, outdoors in Hampstead Heath here, which is one of the largest parks in London, just to be sure that it got nowhere near our kitchen. And every dog within a mile came running over to figure out what the heck was that smelled like that. So we were surrounded by yapping dogs, and just we had to triple wrap the stuff when it was finally, you know, sort of tasted and then, you know, said no more.
Now, there's some of these examples of fierce food where not only do you have to be concerned about what it smells like, but you have to be very, very careful, I gather, about how it's prepared. There's the famous one, the blowfish.
The fugu, yes. I had the pleasure of having this in Tokyo, and a few hundred people every year die in Japan from eating fugu. They tend to be home chefs because fugu chefs in restaurants go through about 2 years of training and then extensive licensing before they're allowed to serve. So they really do know what they're doing.
So you were comfortable sitting down to a...
I was over-comfortable sitting down. It was a beautiful restaurant. And, you know, couldn't have been more elegant. This was going to be a 7-course fugu meal. Unfortunately, what happened was about midway through the 3rd course, my hands went numb. And I thought, okay, this is it. I am going to receive a posthumous Darwin Award that my family is going to have to pick up. Somebody's going to have to explain this to my 2 children. What a stupid, stupid way to die. Because it does start that way. It's a nerve toxin. It causes paralysis, and it spreads from your extremities basically to, you know, your chest and heart, and you stop being able to live. But you're conscious the entire time, which is another interesting factor. And it was about toward the end of course 7 that my fingers started tingling again, and I realized that the chef knew that I was there to write about the experience, and I guess he must have been an absolute genius because he managed to get a few molecules of toxin onto that fish and, you know, give me an experience, but he didn't kill me. And again, that's something that I'm not in a big hurry to try again because it's dicing with death, really.
Has it changed your attitude toward food?
What has changed is that I'm more likely now to go into a restaurant and try something that I've never had before, just for the sake of seeing whether I like it or not. I would tend to stick with my, you know, sort of old favorites prior to writing this book. But it has made me more adventuresome, I'd say. And I know that the benefit is there's always the next meal. If I didn't like this particular one, I just won't finish it. I'll have a nice dessert and, you know, try again the next one.
Journalist Krista Weil is the author of Fierce Food, The Intrepid Diner's Guide to the Unusual, Exotic, and Downright Bizarre.
A root beer for breakfast. Hey, eat dessert first. That's what I'm saying to you, because you never know.
Root beer for breakfast. If you've got questions or comments, want to check a book title, hear something again, head to our website, ttbook.org. And don't go away. It's time for dessert. Food writer and baker Dori Greenspan looks back on a life spent with chocolate, eggs, butter, flour, and sugar. And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge, from PRI, Public Radio International. In his day job, Mort Rosenblum's been a war correspondent, the chief international correspondent for the AP, and executive editor of the International Herald Tribune. In between, and on the side, he explores chocolate. From his houseboat on the Seine in Paris to remote islands off the coast of Africa and Venezuela, Rosenblum set out to discover what makes a great chocolate. He investigated cacao plantations, the secret laboratories of chocolate manufacturers, and the kitchens of artisan chocolatiers. He tells the story in his book Chocolate, A Bittersweet Saga of Dark and Light.
First thing I did is I located the places I thought I'd find the most interesting cacao plantations along the equator. And as I'm also sort of a war reporter in my day job, there happened to be a really handy little war in the Ivory Coast, which grows 40% of the world's cacao, so that worked out. And then I set about trying to find the world's best chocolate makers, wherever I could find them.
All this work that you went to, and yet you live in France, which I understand is maybe the home of the best chocolate in the world.
Well, the truth is, at the end of this 3 years of research, I found that probably the three chocolate makers that I admired the most were within walking distance of my boat in Paris.
So what is it about chocolate? And how long did it take you to discover what it is about chocolate that makes it special?
You know, I discovered, I had this epiphany. I think I was in the shop of a little place, a guy by the name of Jacques Genin, who doesn't even have a store. I mean, I got to the address. I was sure I was wrong. And the door opened 2 inches, and I knew this was the place. I mean, this odor, this aroma came out and wafted me. And I got to know Jacques. And one day, he handed me something, this lovely little square of dark chocolate. And I took a bite. You know, his eyes are kind of sparkling. And I bit into this, and I could just, I mean, there's something about once you learn how to taste chocolate, and that's what really makes the difference, is it's very much like wine, the flavor curve. I mean, you can hear it snap if it's really well made. It dissolves on your back of your tongue and then and goes cleanly away, leaves this wonderful aftertaste.
I'm still curious, though, to know how you developed the ability to tell, because, you know, a lot of Americans eat a lot of milk chocolate.
A lot of candy, yeah. But you can teach yourself. It's very much like wine. I mean, you can, you know, you start with what you know, and then you just explore in different directions and see what you like and give yourself the time and the opportunity to actually taste it and savor it and then go for the good stuff. And in the end, you find, like wine, with chocolate, there's Ripple and there's also Rothschild. I mean, there are some names to keep in mind. There's Valrhona, which is probably the best chocolate factory in the world. It's a small factory in the Rhone Valley. I wrote a chapter called Valrhona Valhalla, and I said it's to chocolate makers, it's the closest thing there is to heaven, except that St. Peter's a lot easier to deal with. As I say, I'm a reporter, and I finally got into the Valrhona factory, but getting into North Korea is a lot easier. I mean, they've kind of started to lighten up a bit, but they're the reason, for example, why there's a wonderful Italian chocolate maker named Amadei. This guy by the name of Tessieri, who went in with his sister and his very, very tough mother, and, you know, they went to visit Valrhona. They wanted to import some Valrhona into Italy, and the French essentially said, no, you Italians aren't ready for this. And so they got really angry. And they went home and they gathered all the family money they could and they began making incredible chocolate. And on top of that, they went to this place, this Chihuahua in Venezuela, and bought a bunch of baseball uniforms and made a bunch of friends and edged out Valrhona to get all the beans. So, you know, some really funny stories. Oh, bitter stuff, nasty stuff, but interesting.
A bitter fight, but sweet chocolate as a result.
Absolutely. I mean, it can get awfully awfully nasty. I mean, Hershey and Mars fought for generations. And, of course, Cadbury and Fred's, nothing like Cadbury and Fry and some of the other Quaker families in England. I remember one time I've got one story I really love. When the Cadburys and the Fries a few generations ago were sharing a plantation in South America, and Cadbury found a way to kind of screw Fry out of the beans and left him without raw material. So when old man Fry died, there was a funeral service for him in Westminster Abbey, this huge cathedral, and it was full. And Cadbury came to the funeral service, but he came in late, and Fry's widow saw him from all the way across these vaults, and she sees him walking. She stands up and yells, "Get out, devil!"
Tell me, what's it like? What's involved in harvesting cocoa beans so that we can all enjoy our chocolate?
Well, it's a lot of work. About 99%, I would guess, of people that harvest cocoa, no matter under what conditions, have never tasted chocolate. 99% of the people who make finished chocolate have never seen a cacao tree. The pods grow directly off the trees and the branches, and they have to be cut off with a sharp machete hook. And then the pods have to be cut open very carefully, so there's maybe 40 or 50 beans inside. And then the beans are scooped out and dried, packed in banana leaves, and fermented for about 8 days. And then they're taken off to Europe in containers. And then there's a whole other process that, for making chocolate from these beans. The beans are roasted and winnowed and ground, and they're melted into what they call chocolate liquor, which isn't liquor, but it's liquid. And then it gets to the final process called conching, where the chocolate just is moved back and forth in these big vats, sometimes for 3 days. And, the volatile flavor elements go, and it builds up this beautiful, smooth texture and wonderful taste. And it's an extremely complex process.
It begins to make sense that chocolate's so expensive. But do any of the people who harvest it see any of that money?
No. As a matter of fact, I talked to a cocoa producer near Ivory Coast, and I was at his plantation, and I noticed back in the bushes there was the remains of a 57 Chevy and a 56 Rambler. I mean, there were, chickens where the engines were, and I mean, the roof was all rusted away and stuff. But it turns out that when his father ran the plantation, if he had a good year, he could buy a Detroit car with white walls and a radio and all. Now, if this guy had a good year, I mean, he'd be lucky to be able to replace the leather on his sandals. It's very difficult. I mean, the problem is there's a whole corrupt middleman system in the Ivory Coast. The marketing system is really bad. I mean, there's a lot of things in the process that, I mean, partly it's the price is determined on a world market. And with all this good chocolate that we're eating now, the really high-end chocolate flavor cocoa that the market calls it, a lot of these producers are, in fact, making the money they deserve. And one, we're getting better cocoa, better chocolate, much better chocolate. And two, the producers are making more money.
Let's go back to the beans for a minute and tell me what you discover you like. And I know that everybody has a different taste. It's the same with wine. You're not going to get two people to agree on what's the best wine. But for you, what do you look for when you now, with your developed palate, go looking for a good chocolate?
Well, the holy grail among chocolate people is a variety called Criollo, which is the original. It's not the original, but it's what the Spanish found when they discovered chocolate and cocoa 500 years ago. The beans are very white, and they're very clear and beautiful, and the pods are oblong-shaped. But it's a very frail tree. It doesn't produce very much. And today, probably only 1% of chocolate is made with Criollo. These beans are still found in a few plantations in Mexico, a few, there's a part in Venezuela, some in Madagascar for some reason. They got carried over there. But there are experiments now, there are experimental plantations south of Lake Maracaibo where they're trying to bring back this old flavor. But Criollo is, when you can find good Criollo, it has a wonderful kind of fruity, long-lasting kind of throaty, earthy flavor, which I really like. Mm.
Do you have a sense of where chocolate is headed?
I think it's headed upward. I think it's headed very much where olive oil was maybe 5-6 years ago, where all of a sudden, I mean, in the United States and elsewhere, I think, as well, where people have discovered, the fact that there is this range, there is this wonderful, ability to mortgage your house and get good chocolate. And so people are willing to spend more money for quality. You're starting to find a lot of appreciation for good chocolate in America.
Mort Rosenblum is chief international correspondent for the AP and the author of Chocolate, a bittersweet saga of dark and light.
Creamy, mellow pleasure, a delicate delight, a luscious bit of chocolate will soothe your appetite.
Come on in and take your shoes off. I'll make you some fudge.
There are chuckophiles and chuckaholics. And then there's Dory Greenspan, a baker and food writer who divides her time between Paris and New York. She knows dessert the way Donald Trump knows money. She has spent years baking with some of the most famous dessert chefs in France, and she can whip a meringue or toss a crepe with the best of them. But her heart is always back home, somewhere near a pan of brownies. Dory's written several award-winning cookbooks, and she's just published the most personal of them, called Baking, From My Home to Yours. She told Anne Strangechamps her unconventional route to pastry prowess began when she was a kid and burned down her parents' kitchen.
I wasn't a cook. I wasn't a baker. I'd never done anything in the kitchen. My parents were away. Friends said, wouldn't it be great to have French fries? So I put a huge pot of oil up to boil, and it was so slow to come to the boil. So I thought, well, if water boils quickly with a cover on it, so would oil. And when I lifted the cover, it was the most beautiful fire I've ever seen. You know how oil has these kind of fabulous flames that, yeah, the whole kitchen. It had just been painted.
So when did you learn to cook?
Not long after that. I was 13 when I burned down the kitchen, and I was almost 20. I was 19 years old when I got married. So I needed to learn to cook and bake then. And I discovered that what I really, really loved was dessert. There's something for me about baking. It's very hands-on for me. It's a very sensuous activity because the ingredients feel good. They smell good. I love the process of baking. I love what you get when you finish baking. But there is something about the process that is so satisfying. And also, although I've spent years and years and years trying to make a case for desserts being one of the major food groups, there really is no reason for dessert except pleasure.
And I also think for people who maybe grew up baking with a parent or a grandmother often, there's a feeling of being on home turf. You know, as soon as you have to get the flour out, there's just a feeling that, okay, I know where I am.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Not that my mother ever cooked or baked. To this day, she still uses her oven as a bread box. But my grandmother was a wonderful baker.
You have actually a recipe if your grandmother's in here. There's a story that goes with it, too.
It's the Russian grandmother's apple pie cake. My grandmother really was a wonderful baker, and I think she worried that my mother never cooked or baked and that we as children would be deprived. And so every week she would bring not just desserts, she'd bring food as well, but she would bring this wonderful apple cake. It was a cake. It's so hard to describe, even now that I've made it so many times. But it's got a kind of bottom layer of, it could be called crust, but it's really like a firmish cake. And then it has a middle layer of apples that would be like apple pie filling, and then there's another layer of this crust. And my grandmother would make this in big pans, and she would cut it in diamond shapes, and she would bring it to us in a shoebox. As a kid, I didn't wonder about it, but now I think, where did she get all those shoeboxes? I mean, every week there was a shoebox with this apple cake. I never got the recipe from my grandmother. You know, she died, and I asked in the family if anybody had it, and everybody had something that they considered, oh, this is grandma's apple cake. And nothing ever tasted the way I remembered it tasting as a child. And a few years ago, I was giving a class in upstate New York, and a woman came up to me at the end of the class, and she said she was going to Paris, and she was wondering if I could help her with some recommendations for restaurants in Paris, because I spend a lot of time there. And I said, sure. We exchanged emails, and when I got back to New York, I had an email from her saying, I'm sending you a recipe. It's for my grandmother's apple cake. I just got shivers when I read that email, and I looked at the recipe, and it looked as close as anything I had seen to my grandmother's cake. And I made it. I tasted it. I was so excited. My mother lives in Florida now. I flew to Florida with some of this cake, gave her a taste, and said, what do you think? She actually thought it was better than she remembered my grandmother's being.
Oh, that's great. So you fell in love with cooking and with baking, but what led you to want to actually make this a career?
I had other career before this. I went to graduate school. I did a doctorate in gerontology. And when I didn't finish my dissertation, after I had a child, I thought, really, the thing that I love is baking. This is what I would love to do. And at the time, it was 1981. My mother was expecting to say Dr. Dory, not Baker Dory, who was earning, you know, $4 an hour in a basement. It wasn't glamorous to be in a kitchen then. It wasn't sexy to be a chef. Now the food world is just, I mean, I've always thought it's a wonderful world, but now it's really, it seems exciting to people.
Well, and now then, it's so much about expression. But in fact, weren't you fired from your first job for being a little too expressive?
I got a little bored. I got this job, and my job, because I was the newest kid on the block, was to bake this chocolate cake that was made with ground almonds and whiskey-soaked raisins. So one day I thought, I'm bored. I'm really bored. I don't want to make this cake again. So I decided to play around a little bit, and instead of the almonds, I used ground pecans, and instead of the whiskey, I used Armagnac. And this is, I think, what really did me in. Instead of the raisins, I used prunes. So I made a prune Armagnac chocolate cake, and I sent it upstairs with the waiter, but I never bothered telling anybody I'd changed the recipe. And I guess I really didn't know that the cake that I had changed was the restaurant's signature cake. And so after service, the owner of the restaurant called me in, and she said, that was some cake you made today. And I said, did you like it? And she said, well, yeah, it was very interesting. I said, you liked it. She said, don't ever do that again. So that's when I said, well, I'll never do it again. I promise I'll never do it again. And she said, you're right, you'll never do it again. You're fired. Fired. I was fired for prunes. And so, but the best thing was, though it took me months to realize that this was the best thing, she said I was fired for creative insubordination. So I thought, you know, there's hope for me yet.
So which recipe did you include in the book?
Well, I included, great question. I included the one that got me fired. So it's the chocolate prune Armagnac cake. But then in lots of my recipes, I have a little sidebar that's called Playing Around that gives you ideas for how to vary the recipe. And so for the cake that got me fired, the Playing Around is the original recipe.
Mm-hmm. You moved to France eventually, and you've lived there and in New York for years. In France, I have the impression that desserts and pastry chefs are fashionable in a way they aren't in this country. I mean, there are celebrity desserts, right?
It's so true, particularly in Paris. In Paris, the celebrity pastry chefs present their collections, their dessert collections, the way fashion designers show their collection. So there's the fall-winter collection, the spring-summer collection.
So what are the big fashionable desserts in Paris right now?
Well, it's interesting. Violet as a flavor and a color is very fashionable. Orange flower water. And then there's a flavor trio that Pierre Hermé is responsible for, but you see it everywhere and you see it in the most fabulous forms. The combination is rose, lychee, and raspberry.
Wow.
Wow is right. It's a fabulous combination.
So give me an example of how you'd see that.
Well, you might have a rose-flavored macaroon, so it would be this beautiful pink bottom layer. Rose cream in the center, and that would be like a whipped cream or a buttercream that's flavored with essence of rose petals, fresh lychees and raspberry in that layer, and then a rose macaroon on top.
Now, this is an example of kind of haute cuisine baking at its most evolved. But the book that you've just done is a book of home baking recipes, the kind of stuff that you do every day. What made you want
exactly
to do that kind of book?
Because that's really the way I bake. I mean, I've been so lucky in my baking life because I've gotten to work with great, great pastry chefs. But no matter how many elaborate and haute desserts I worked on with these chefs, I always came home and made chocolate chip cookies. I'm really, my love is home baking.
Well, then I have to ask you about brownies because, I mean, I knew it was a home baking book, and so I expected maybe one, maybe two recipes for brownies.
I got carried away, right?
Yeah, they're 12.
I like brownies. Can you tell?
But how many different recipes can you need for brownies?
Need has nothing to do with it. Neat has nothing to do with it. It just means you get to play around. So you can have dark chocolate brownies. You can have, actually, one of my favorites are the quintuple brownies. So it has five different kinds of chocolate. I have white chocolate brownies with raspberries and a meringue top. That's kind of the dressy brownie.
Dory, why are you not fat? I mean, I know you're a small woman.
I'm a small woman. Okay, there are a couple of things. I eat so slowly. I'm always the last person at the table, and I think that that helps. So I really like to eat slowly. I savor everything. But I think that the key is to bake, to taste everything, and then the big word is share. I give so much stuff away. My neighbors love me. Love me. We live in an old building in New York City that still has an elevator operated by a human. And my elevator men adore me because they're there 24 hours a day and I bake at all hours. So they know when I'm ringing the bell at a funny time, there are cookies in their future. So, you know, I think it's a little bit like fishermen who, you know, catch and release. This is the same principle for baking. You know, taste and give.
Bake and release. Dory, thanks so much for talking.
Oh, thank you so much for being interested.
Dory Greenspan talking with Anne Strangechamps. Dory's book is called Baking, From My Home to Yours. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Copies of today's show are available at the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Forbidden Foods, program number 48A. Feeling hungry yet?
Custard pie, the way to a man's heart.
She takes two cans of tomatoes, dumps them in a pan, and adds enough brown sugar to kill a normal man. She takes her homemade bread, breaks it into chunks. She's a shaking and a baking. If I was drinking, I'd be drunk.
You take a little butter, a third of a cup. You dump it in a bowl and then you cover it up with 3 cups of chocolate chips and use the good kind.
Take 2/3 cups of flour, a teaspoonful of salt, a quarter pound of butter.
Sweetened cocoa, 1/2 cup of boiling water, 1/4 cup of butter, and 1/4 cup of shortening, 2 cups sugar, 1/8 teaspoon salt, teaspoon of vanilla, 1 1/2 teaspoons baking soda. Excuse me just a sec.
2 squares of dark chocolate, walnuts, pecan sugar, a teaspoon of baking powder.
Taste, but I know it tastes good, and there's a taste of my baby's tomato pudding.
This kitchen is closed. That's right.
PRI, Public Radio International.